Hey, this is Sandy.
And Randy.
And we're here on AT Corner.
Being an athlete trainer comes with ups and downs, and we're here to showcase it all.
Join us as we share our world in sports medicine.
Welcome back to another episode of AT Corner. For this week's education episode, we have an interview from the Memorial Hermann Sports Medicine Update. This session had a lot of great speakers and a lot of great topics, but I feel like when the program came out and we saw it, this is the one that Sandra had circled as probably one of her ones that she was looking forward to.
Absolutely. I was so lucky to be able to sit down with Dr. Matt Camarillo, who is a physician and orthopedic surgeon actually out in Texas, who shared with us the incidence of spinal cord injuries, stabilization techniques, what goes on beyond the field. And I think most importantly, that it doesn't just happen in football, because for me, I've had a couple of cervical spine incidences and injuries that I've dealt with, and they've not all been in football. One was actually in performing arts, so I thought it was really cool to talk to him about the incidents beyond just what we think about.
Absolutely. And also, didn't you have like back-to-back days of spine boarding, dude?
Unfortunately, I did, and we do talk about that later in the episode. But really, this is just important to talk about no matter what time of year.
Yes.
And not just right before you go into your football season.
Yes, absolutely.
We do owe a huge thank you to Jeremy Jackson and the Sports Medicine Broadcast, as he was able to get us out to the Memorial Hermann Sports Medicine Update so that we could bring this to you. And without further ado, here we go.
All right, here we go in 3, 2, 1. What's up, y'all? Welcome to the Sports Medicine Broadcast, a podcast to promote and improve your practice as an athletic trainer. I'm Jeremy Jackson, host, but today Randy and Sandy from AT Corner are joining me to interview Dr. Matt Camarillo, talking about backboarding of the injured athlete. Without much further ado, this is sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/backboarding. So thanks for joining us live at the 2023 Memorial Hermann Sports Medicine Update. Sandy, you got it.
Thank you, Jeremy. So Matt, how common are these spinal cord injuries?
If you look at the athletes in the U.S., it's only about 9 to 10% a year. Okay. So there's about 12,000 nationally. And when we're talking about spinal cord injuries, we're talking about people, not just for spine boarding, but the people that ended up with some kind of neurological or incomplete recovery after their injury is about 12,000 nationwide. Only about 9 to 10% of those are associated with the athletic population.
Just looking at the physicals that are coming in now, I have a couple of athletes who have had previous spinal cord injuries. What are some things that I might be more aware of when I'm taking care of these athletes?
Yeah, you know, people who had it is mainly due to, one is a trauma, two is because they were born with some cervical stenosis. And I think making sure they've been seen by a spine surgeon that's really associated with the athletic population. I've seen several that have just been disqualified because they have cervical stenosis, but they don't necessarily hit the qualifications that they should be out of any contact sport. So I think making sure that they're seen by someone that understands the sport and not just always looking at a book of saying, this is what it is. And so we're blessed here in Houston to have several of those spine surgeons here. Some great ones up in Dallas too, that a lot of times if they've been disqualified, refer them that way. So they can give them all the research, the risk benefits, and making sure that the parents, the athlete, and everyone's on the same understanding of what could happen, but making sure they're given the ability to do that, to play if they like to.
That makes sense. So a lot of education, which we take into consideration with a lot of other things. You know, we talk about spinal cord injuries, and the first thing that we think of is football. And we think, you know, it's equipment heavy. It's collision based, and you know, we talk about the equipment removal for that, but what is the incidence in other sports?
You know, honestly, they didn't break it down because I think, you know, you look at most research and athletic populations around football, but we know that it happens in lacrosse, hockey, gymnastics, even in, you can get an occasional soccer or baseball where there's contact, basketball as well. So those can all happen. The research just isn't there on the correct thing. I think if, you know, if you look at the research, if they have helmet and shoulder pads for whatever sport, then those keep them in neutral alignment. If they only have a helmet, that helmet probably needs to come off. But I think it's just based on the sport, but there's not a whole lot of research to support that.
Okay. These spinal cord injuries, you also, I think if I remember the number correctly in your talk, I think you said there were about 12,000 per year
Are these spinal cord injuries with awareness and education, are we increasing these, decreasing these?
So if you look at it, 12,000, that's nationwide for all, including automobile accidents, MCCs, things like that. I think those, a lot of those you can't prevent. And even the football, not all those injuries you can prevent, but I think you can prevent a lot of them with, you know, making sure the tackling technique's correct and enforcement with the referees and making sure they're enforcing that as well as the coaches, but making sure the helmet and shoulder pads, if you look at it, they kind of average out. But if you look at since 1975, when they first started documenting all these, it's definitely gone down.
Is there a reason for that?
I think it's just more awareness to it, okay, more than anything. I think when you put awareness to it, it really heightens everyone. And I think if we don't put awareness to it, we'll probably see those go up again.
So moving back into narrowing down into more of an athletic training setting and working with like sport athletes, for example, what would be our initial assessment? What are some red flags for, I need to move on and actually get this person on the spine board?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is I always say that anyone, if they have a big trauma, like a head-on hit and they're unconscious or also level of consciousness, you run into the idea, do they have a concussion or is there a spot, and they can't give you a clear answer. So a lot of it is clinical judgment on that. I think if they have any numbness bilaterally, which kind of differentiate it from a brachial plexus injury or a stinger, mm-hmm. Is more in line with something more central as a, something more unilateral. And then naturally, if there's any deformity, meaning, you know, their head's in a, which I don't know if you'd actually see in an athletic part, you see that more with car accidents, but if you notice palpating on their C-spine, I feel a huge step off, that's definitely a red flag as well. And I think in the cervical spine, a lot of pain. As I showed in my, on that one case presentation, his biggest red flag was he was in a lot of pain. And this is a wrestler, football player who was saying, my neck just hurts. And there was no, it was tender midline as well as paraspinal, but he just said, this thing hurts like crazy. He had no neurological deficits. So some of it, you always just trust your gut. You don't want to spine board 10 people in one football game. and that's why it's helpful for the athletic trainer to know the athlete, oh no, you know, every time he gets beat, he goes down type thing versus this is a big kid and we didn't know he was actually in a different gym than the main stadium when they were doing it. So we didn't see that. And then once we heard the kind of history that he came straight down on his head with all that pain, it kind of made the decision relatively easy to transport at that point.
So once you decide to stabilize someone, what, I know you talked about two different methods. What is your preferred method of stabilization?
If there's enough qualified hands, I like the six-man lift, and I think that's been shown in the literature as well, as there's decreased cervical motion when you're lifting up as opposed to rolling. That being said, if you don't have enough help, no one's going to fault you for doing a log roll. And you, there's no way to do a six-man lift if the person's in a prone position. Because like I said, the athletes never fall straight down back on their back in neutral alignment. You always have to make those alterations. The thing is trying to do everything methodical. And I think the biggest thing is just trying to minimize the motion as best you can.
Speaking of minimizing motion, I know, like you said, not everyone's going to fall perfectly straight on their back, ready to be stabilized. But when is it appropriate to move the neck into neutral or the...
I think it's always as long as you have that head squeeze or the trap squeeze to put it back in neutral, because if they're tilted one way or another, they're blocking off their airway too, so we don't have good access to the airway. So if they're unconscious, if they need a secondary breathing tube or anything, we have to put it in a neutral position. So I think it's always appropriate to get them in a more neutral position just to establish the airway.
Can you talk a little bit about the differences between a head... head and a trap?
Yeah, so the head squeeze is more basically putting your hands around the helmet or the athlete's head as opposed to a trap squeeze where you're going down and putting your thumbs and your index fingers across their traps. And it basically gives you more stability because you're stabilizing their head versus your forearms versus just holding your hands there, because there is a point where you can get fatigued too and you're just adding in motion. So I think it's more ergonomic, but I think it gives more stability to the cervical spine as well.
You know, actually... it's a great idea that we practice, and this really came into consideration just a few weeks ago when we were doing spring football at my college. And something that I didn't think about is I was wearing a puffy jacket that was very slick. And so when I went to practice a log roll, now granted I was holding some other stuff, so, you know, but the helmet slipped right out my arms because I was wearing a puffy jacket. And that's something that, you know, I have worn to football practice before. So now I'm like, oh, now I have to consider if I'm going to do the trap squeeze, I have to really pay attention to external factors. What can make that helmet slip?
Yeah, and I think that's why it's practicing and figuring out how everything works. Because once you get it down, then there's a lot of adrenaline and emotion rolling when that actually happens. But if you practice over and over again, it just becomes a routine. And like I said, on that one wrestler, we were made the decision to spine board into the EMS within 5 minutes and all the way to the hospital because it was something we had practiced multiple times. So everything just flowed naturally with athletic trainers as well as the EMS crew as well.
What are some tips you have for someone who is working with an equipment-intensive sport like hockey that they're not as familiar with the equipment?
Practice. Get in there with your equipment manager and see how things work. I couldn't tell you how to put on a hockey helmet or mask or shoulder pads, but I think if I was covering something like that, that would be something I'd want to learn relatively quick because there's always practice stuff that you can do. They always take them apart to service them and look at it and see how it works because you don't want to be unfamiliar when something happens. These don't happen. This is why we practice, because they don't happen on a routine basis. But when they do happen, you want everything to go right.
Mm-hmm, definitely. You also talked about the post after someone gets spine boarded and they are on their way to the hospital. What does it look like once they are at the hospital?
So once they're at the hospital, we do that equipment removal as we showed in the video. They'll go into a cervical collar at that point, and then straight to a CT scan is the initial one. So the CT scan is quick, readily available, and then based on that, then it would be an automatic neurosurgery or orthopedic spine surgeon consult on there. Because a lot of these, the middle school kids sometimes, they'll have nothing that you'll see on the CT scan. They'll need an MRI, but they just see some core signal change, but there's no fracture. So that's why we, on any suspicion of spinal cord injuries, we transport to our level one because we have all the facilities we need there. We don't want to transport one place and then have to get on a helicopter and we're doing multiple moves. We make that call and we head to the level one where we have all the capabilities.
Can you talk about some the differences between, I know that there's been a lot of talk about different places that have stopped spine boarding or have been treating some of these spinal cord injuries in athletics more like motorcycle accidents?
Yeah, I think it's two different mechanisms, and I think it's two different schools of thought, and that's what you get in medicine. You always have different ways. I think most of the research around that I showed today is around the football athlete as opposed to the motorcycle accident, things like that. So I think there's schools of thought. And that was what we approached with the EMS probably 4 years ago. Their literature said, oh, we don't need a spine board. We don't need a, well, this is completely different. And that's why we had them, hey, let's, you want to try this scoop board? Let's try it on this, on full pads on a field, sport turf that's not grass, and let's see how that works. So I think sometimes just education and coming up with a compromise, but then making sure when the time comes, everyone's on the same page. The last thing you want to do is have any showdown when you're trying to, the number one priority is the patient or the athlete, and we want to take care of them.
Yeah, definitely as an athletic trainer, you're going to come across a lot of different EMS squads. I was working youth football one night, and then the next night I was working a high school football. And just the back-to-back, unfortunately, I did have two injuries where I did have to spine board back-to-back. However, one night I had a crew that put them on a spine board, and then the next night in a different county, 2 hours away, they didn't spine board. So again, it's about being flexible and, you know, you can't get to the EMS squad ahead of time every single time, you know, but definitely if you're in a place that you're, like at a college or a high school or, somewhere where you're more familiar or where you're going to be staying in the area, you can definitely have those conversations with EMS ahead of time.
Yeah, and there's always the ability, if you don't feel comfortable with something they're doing, is to ask for a supervisor, and that's what we've asked our athletic trainers. If they're doing something that we haven't talked about, hey, can we call the supervisor? Because these are big EMS areas, and you can't control what everyone does or what everyone remembers. So it's one of those, hey, let's stop, the athlete's stable, and can we call for the supervisor, is always a easy way to do that instead of having kind of any back and forth or anything.
You also talked about the order of on the helmet, which which the side pieces you're supposed to take off first. Can you talk a little bit about the order of that?
Yeah, the reason you take out the side pieces first is you can flip the helmet, the face mask up, and that gives you immediate access. So if you need to get to the airway the quickest, then you want to take the sides and you can roll that up to easily get to the airway. You'd ideally want to take off all those, but if you have, for some reason, you need to start CPR, you need to put a secondary breathing device in, it gives you quick access to that area.
I know I've been looking a little bit at CPR with shoulder pads, and with a spinal cord injury, if you're having to do CPR and you're removing the equipment, you would leave the shoulder pads in place as long as you open them up?
I open them up, but I think if you're getting into a CPR case, you're probably going ahead and taking everything off, because at that point it's more emergency situation where you have to get the circulatory system moving as opposed to, and then still trying to do CPR with it. But I think in those situations, I think you're probably looking at removing everything at that point, which hopefully is extremely rare that you're getting both situations. But that's why, you know, everyone has to be versed on being able to take the helmet and shoulder pad off if needed.
Definitely. Do you have any recommendations for an athletic trainer who has not a lot of volunteers or staff, or anyone in who might just be working alone?
You have coaches.
Perfect.
And train the coaches. All my athletic trainers have access to the videos that we did, so they can show it to their coaches, because you always have football coaches that are there, and I'm making sure they're online, especially a middle school game. There's probably one athletic trainer there. There's not a whole lot of – it's not like a Friday or Saturday night where you have EMS crew and multiple athletic trainers. So making sure your coaches are in line with helping you do all that.
And then also you talked about with the incidence of these injuries not as high in NFL or higher levels, and then kind of the highest incidence I saw on the chart that you had was in middle school and high school. Can you talk a little bit about why?
I think it's still learning appropriate tackling technique, not leading with your head. I think the middle school is tackling technique, but also making sure that we're fitting the helmet and shoulder pads appropriately. I think that's where it goes down to. I think at the varsity level, there's probably more eyes on it than at the middle school level, where you have multiple kids and coming in and out, and not the newest equipment all the time as well.
Great. Is there anything else that we didn't touch upon that you wanted to add?
No, I think the biggest thing is educating and preparing and making sure everyone's on the same page. Take the time during the off season to get with your EMS crew. Use your team doctor and their medical director to make sure everyone's online, because that's where everything flows smoothly on all that.
Yeah. All right, Dr. Camarillo, any way you'd like to connect with people, social media, email?
Yeah, I can. I have. You want me to send? My email's really long.
Well, I have the. I can get the email from Bob.
Yeah, so. Yeah, we'll send that out. Cool. If they have any questions, absolutely. Yeah. I'm not on any social media, so we'll send an email. So.
Makes life easier.
Yep.
So for Jeremy Jackson, Randy and Sandy from the AT Corner, Dr. Matt Camarillo, and the Sports Medicine Update 2023, this is the Sports Medicine Broadcast, and this one is sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/backboarding. Again, backboarding would be one word, sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/backboarding. Dr. Camarillo, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
One of the biggest things I got out of this episode is, one, trust your gut, and two, practice.
100%. I think another thing that was a really cool takeaway, and especially when they started talking about like emergency scenarios as a whole for like the conference, is communicating with EMS like prior, having a game plan before an emergency actually happens, and understanding whose role is what's their policies and stuff like that. Like I liked how, you know, our past interview episodes that we've done on it have brought that up, but also this one, going into that, hey, talking to EMS before, you know, you're stabilizing someone's C-spine to understand what are we going to do?
I mean, sometimes you don't always know what you're going into.
For sure.
We did talk about that in the episode, but especially as we are going into the summer now, so a lot of times people are going to pick up some per diem. And
there's
or even if you are working at somewhere that you have been for a long time, there are new people coming in. And so this is a time that you really don't know 100% of the histories of people walking in. Even if you do medical histories and you do your pre-participation exam, sometimes people just check no.
You mean the athletes just try to get it done as fast as possible?
Hmm.
Weird.
Never.
They wouldn't do that.
So sometimes you never know what you're walking into. So you always have to be prepared. And it's not, like we said before, it's not just football. So that's something that if you're working with hockey, if you're working with lacrosse, if you're working with
basketball,
honestly, baseball and softball catchers.
Yeah.
Working with their equipment and trying to figure out how you would deal with that situation.
Yeah, for sure. 100%.
If you guys are new, we do every other episode as education or stories. This one was an education episode. Next week, we are going back to our story episodes. And if you would like to submit a story for that episode, make sure you go to our Instagram at @ATCornerPodcast. And those will be in the prompts will be up in our Instagram stories. And make sure you check the show notes for some cool promo codes for some things and some other CU opportunities.
Oh, yeah, it's never too early to start thinking ahead.
Hey, that kind of goes with the theme of this.
Hey, I didn't even try to do that.
Do you have anything else to add, Randy?
Nope, that was perfect. Thank you for helping us showcase athletic training behind the tape. Bye.